Welcome to the Model Railroader, your ultimate destination for all things railroading. From trains.com, we bring you step-by-step modeling and construction projects, insightful reviews, tips from the experts, and more. This program is proudly presented by Aftersight, a community hub for audio news, entertainment, and resources. Find us at aftersight.org. This program is intended to be used solely by individuals who are blind or have low vision. All aboard!
Thank you for joining us for the Model Railroader magazine, read by Jason Consul. The first article is Big Sky Country in N Scale. You can visit this 38 by 52 foot layout during the 2025 NMRA National Convention. By Ken Chick, photos by Craig Wilson. The fictional history of my N-scale Danforth, Hadley, and Northern, or DH&N, dates back to the late 1880s. James Douglas III of Danforth, Montana, became fascinated with trains and decided to invest the fortune he had made raising cattle in railroads. Building a railroad would be tough, but he needed a new challenge and was young and eager to do something different. In March 1888, his railroad's tracks crossed the Hadley River and headed west toward the Pacific Ocean. By 1913, James's fortune was gone and the DH&N fell into receivership. It remained there for 4 years until the Northern Pacific, or NP, recognized the line's worth and purchased it to complement its existing lines. The DH&N used the nickname the Way West. The NP pushed the line further west until it reached Garrison, Montana. This became the westernmost interchange between NP and its subsidiary, the DH&N. The Danforth, Hadley, and Northern, and Northern Pacific, both merged into the Burlington Northern in March 1970. My Model Railroad depicts the two lines circa 1955. Getting hooked on N-scale. Like many hobbyists, my journey in model railroading started with Lionel when I was around 5 years old. My fascination with trains eventually gave way to a number of other teenage interests. After being discharged from the Army, I ran into Rick Strong, an old high school buddy, who had just returned from a visit to Germany. He brought back some beautiful N-scale steam engines that ran like Swiss watches. I decided it was time to get back into model railroading. Rick and two of his friends had just started an N-scale mail order business around that time. He offered me a 20% discount on anything I purchased, so N-scale seemed the way to go. Rick's business grew and soon moved to a store and then a larger building selling all scales. Eventually, the train center became one of the premier hobby shops in the Detroit metropolitan area. Finding the perfect space. I owned a ranch house with a large basement when I returned to the hobby. I walled off one end of it and began building an experimental model railroad. I started developing a variety of new model railroading skills. It was fun, and I learned a lot, especially what worked and what didn't. We then moved to a bigger house, but with a smaller basement. I built another learning railroad at this location. In 1996, my wife, Beverly, and I moved into our present home, where all of that learning was put into practice. Around the same time, I also became a member of the Midnight Pocatello Yardmasters, a round-robin club with several fine modelers. My wife loved our house because the master bedroom and laundry room were all on the first floor. I loved it because the only things in the 1,800-square-foot basement were the furnace and water heater. The floor was a concrete slab, the walls were poured concrete without any seams or concrete-form tie holes, and there was no ceiling. A perfect blank canvas. I soon replaced the traditional water heater with a tankless version that required less space. Before starting on the layout, I had the basement finished. The walls were insulated and drywalled, a tile floor was installed, and a drop ceiling was added. I selected fluorescent tubes to illuminate the space, as they were the most efficient at the time. If I were starting today, I would use light-emitting diodes. There were 52 single-fixture tubes hung end-to-end above the outer edge of the benchwork. This setup eliminated side-to-side shadows and dark spots. The lights are hidden behind an aluminum valance curved to match the benchwork. The rest of the room features traditional fluorescent fixtures in the drop ceiling. This produces plenty of light when we're working on the railroad. However, when we run trains, we only use the layout lighting. A separate panel with 8 new circuit breakers was installed for everything on the layout. In addition, a wall was built to section off the workshop, kitchenette, and bathroom. A separate room for the furnace, water heater, and dispatcher's desk was also constructed. Getting started. Before work started on the layout, standards were developed for the DH and N that were reviewed by members of my operating crew. Key elements included 3-foot minimum aisles, 24-inch minimum radius curves, 1.5% maximum grade, and 52-inch minimum track height. It was about this time that there were some major changes in the hobby. Digital command control was in its early stages, and Railcraft began offering N-scale Code 55 track with proper-sized ties and extremely small spikes, 8 per tie, that allowed locomotives and freight cars with quote-unquote pizza cutter flanges to operate smoothly. Railcraft was later sold to Micro Engineering. Because of these changes, I sold all my Pico track and switches and boxed up my old True Action Throttles, or TAT4, that I built from kits and Lynn Westcott articles in Model Railroader. There were no Code 55 switches when I started work on the layout, only switch kits. They consisted of rails, points, and frogs, but no ties. I purchased a large supply of flex track and about 150 switch kits in 4 sizes. I built jigs for the switch ties. Though others don't notice, the ties under the frogs are prototypically closer together than the others. When I ran out of switch kits, I started using Fast Tracks jigs. Eventually, I made more than 250 turnouts, as well as 3 double slip switches. Even after building hundreds of switches, the double slips proved considerably more difficult. The first keeper took 3 tries. Benchwork and scenery. I constructed the model railroad using L-girder benchwork. This proved beneficial, as there were many times when I was installing turnouts for the yard throat that I had to move supports to accommodate switch machines. I mounted all of the switch machines on Rix racks under layout mounting brackets, which allowed for easy adjustment of the point throw. I placed homasote over the plywood in towns and switching areas. I used homasote on spline roadbed between locations. The spline roadbed allowed for beautiful easements on all of the curves. The mainline track was laid on cork roadbed. I installed thinner cork for the passing sidings and laid the yard tracks directly on the homasote. I used many techniques to scenic the layout. In some areas, I used extruded foam insulation board, which I carved with knives and a hot wire cutter. I covered the foam with what members of my operating crew called oatmeal scenery. When mixed properly, this is what the cellulite, zonolite, water, white glue, and coloring has the consistency of. It kind of looks like it, too. The oatmeal was then spread in various thicknesses to achieve the desired look. While it was still wet, I covered the mixture with real dirt that was sifted to get it as fine as possible. Then it was topped with traditional scenery materials. I used diluted white glue to hold the scenery in place. Another benefit of the oatmeal scenery was that it took a few days to dry, so it stayed workable longer than regular materials. Trees were easy to plant, whether material is wet or dry. In other areas, I used geodesic foam scenery from Bragdon Enterprises. I found this to be my favorite method for making the mountains, as they're hollow, which lets me reach hidden tracks. Over the years, I made molds from rocks and pieces of coal that I found during my travels. Some of the molds are more than a foot square. When the castings were stitched together, they looked very realistic. Locomotives and rolling stock. Many of my engines have sound. I've added decoders to most of my older locomotives. For steam engines, I put the decoder in the tender. On older diesels, I milled away part of the frame. Over the years, I've upgraded my rolling stock. All of the cars have body-mounted couplers and metal wheel sets with low-profile flanges. The cars are weathered based on age and service. Uncoupling N-scale equipment can be challenging. I installed track magnets in hard-to-reach places, but members of my operating crew prefer to use uncoupling tools. Our tool of choice was designed by fellow N-scale modeler Gary Miller. It consists of a paintbrush handle cut off at the ferrule with a long, thin piece of brass inserted into it. The tip of the brass is filed to a point. An operating layout. The DH and N was designed to be an operating railroad with multiple switching areas, long runs, and a high ratio of scenery to track. The main line is more than 400 feet long. About a third of that is double track. The rest is single track. This was done to enhance operating interest and introduce some challenges. The engineer slash conductor needs to work closely with the dispatcher to keep trains moving. There are approximately 15 modeled towns on the railroad. Almost all of them have one or more passing sidings. The DH and N is a point-to-point railroad with a major yard and engine facilities at Billings and staging yards at Garrison and East Billings. Somewhere along the way, I developed an interest in the NP. Consequently, there's a lot of NP motive power and rolling stock, including two North Coast Limited train sets, numbers 25 and 26. My layout is set in 1955, so I can run the trains with dome cars. All of the towns, modeled in name only, are from the Northern Pacific's Rocky Mountain Division. The DH and N runs from Huntley, Montana, to Garrison, Montana. There are also two branch lines, one from Mossman to Hobson, and another connecting Livingston with Garrison via Logan, Montana. Running trains. There are more than 20 trains on the DH and N schedule, though we rarely run all of them during an operating session. A fast clock, set at 8 to 1, allows us to cover a full day in 3 hours. The switch lists are computer-generated. I once looked at some commercial switch list programs, but none seemed to be a good fit. Consequently, I generate new switch lists for each operating session. Nothing really changes for the passenger trains except for occasionally switching Railway Express agency cars. I decide which freight cars get set out or picked up at industries and yards. There's a sign-up board for scheduled and extra trains. These jobs are called by the dispatcher, who also controls train movements. When an engineer is ready to depart a town, he must call the dispatcher to report how many cars are in the train and get permission to leave. This helps the dispatcher, who has a track diagram panel with the capacity of the passing tracks, determine where trains may pass or overtake each other. Engineers waiting for a train can relax in the crew lounge. It has a television, a kitchenette with snacks, and a refrigerator with beverages. Just getting started. My N-scale Danforth, Hadley, and Northern is more than 30 years old. I've never been in a hurry to finish the model railroad, and it probably never will be completed. I've always believed that the journey is the reward, and I get great pleasure in the work. There are areas on the DH and N that are yet to be completed. The smelter at Mossman needs to be built, which will require about 20 small structures. The smelter will be modeled after a prototype in Hancock, Michigan. I was fortunate to receive a special tour of the facility several years after it closed and took many photos. I also obtained a blueprint of the facility's layout. I plan to expand the yard in Livingston to improve operations. East Billings also needs some more buildings, better roads, and scenery. Why did I choose to model an N-scale? Initially because of Rick Strong, but also because I liked the scenery to track ratio. If I were starting today, would I do things differently? Certainly. I'd probably still choose N, but switch from freelance to prototype modeling. The DH and N has, and continues to be, a great source of fun. Along the way, I earned my NMRA Master Model Railroader certificate and plaque. Now I spend time helping others in the area work towards theirs. Model railroading is fun, and the friendships are really special. Meet Ken Chick. Ken Chick lives in Northville, Michigan. He's a longtime member of the Midnight Pocatello Yardmasters and is active in Division 6 of the National Model Railroad Association's North Central Region. Ken, a master model railroader, also serves as an NMRA Achievement Program Assistant, helping other model railroaders work toward and receive their various achievement program awards. The next article is Evolution on the Mighty MKT. How this N-scale layout evolved from 1990 to today. By Brett Overholzer. Photos by Dan Munson. Change is inevitable on layouts that have been around for a long time. My layout, the Missouri-Kansas-Texas Railroad St. Louis Subdivision, has been a work in progress since 1990. During that time, many changes have occurred due to advancing technology, changes in priorities, and refinements in the way I like to do things. All of these have resulted in an improved and more satisfying layout. The St. Louis Subdivision, or as my operating friends ironically like to call it, the Mighty MKT, is located in a portion of my home's basement in Lenexa, Kansas, a suburb of Kansas City. I say ironically because the layout is relatively small compared to some of the mega layouts that have been built in the Kansas City area. The operations-oriented layout models the northern portion of the Missouri-Kansas-Texas route across central Missouri. I model 1984, which allows me to run a variety of modern diesel locomotives, such as EMD SD40-2s, and some of the more colorful paint schemes that were present on the MKT. In 1984, a locomotive consist could comprise a non-repainted Conrail GP40, Old Illinois Central Gulf, or ICG, rust buckets, a faded former Penn Central locomotive, and an oddball high-nose GP39-2 in rusted yellow Kennecott copper paint with not a Katy Green locomotive in sight. Those were the days. Though I try to adhere to prototype practices, I describe my sessions as quote-unquote proto-enhanced, since the MKT ran only two trains a day, mostly trailer-on-flatcore, or TOFC, on the St. Louis Sub in 1984. My operating scheme has evolved over time, but now includes trains based on earlier eras mapped over to my 1984 baseline. Some of the industries on the layout are based on prototypes, but extra businesses have been added to generate more traffic and operational interest for the crews. The layout. The St. Louis Sub is a single-level, point-to-point railroad with staging in an adjacent portion of the basement. A dispatcher's desk in the basement is used during operating sessions. Staging on the east end represents Baden Yard in St. Louis, parentheses, the northernmost point on the railroad, close parentheses. Staging on the west end represents Sedalia, Missouri, and destinations south and west on the railroad. The staging yard has 17 staging tracks, including both single-ended and double-ended tracks, all controlled by the dispatcher during operating sessions. A balloon loop connects the two staging yards and is used between sessions to help restage the trains. All of the cities on the layout exist in the real world and are placed in the correct geographical order. My goal was for a local visitor to come down to the basement and have a sense of familiarity with the layout based on visual, parentheses scenery, close parentheses, and geographical cues. Out of Sedalia staging, eastbound trains first encounter the town of Boonville. Here, the MKT interchanges with Union Pacific. The UP has a job at Boonville that works the local industries. This is a popular job during operating sessions, keeping a crew busy during the session, working, and rail fanning the MKT line. North of Boonville, just as on the prototype, the MKT track crosses over the Missouri River and UP's former Missouri Pacific track. This bridge is a hinged, lift-up section that allows access to the layout for the crew lounge. Just past the bridge, we enter New Franklin, Missouri. Franklin Yard is the largest on the layout. Here I've taken a little bit of modeler's license and built the yard larger than the prototype as it existed in 1984, along with additional industries to increase operational interest. I added the New Franklin Industrial Park that doesn't exist in the real world. The yardmaster here needs the extra space to build locals, serve local industries, and work the main line through trains during an operating session. Indeed, many yardmasters suggest that additional tracks are needed. Eastbound out of New Franklin, the railroad travels past tall limestone cliffs near the town of Rocheport. You can see these cliffs while driving along Interstate 70 as you cross over the Missouri River. At North Jefferson, the next town east on the layout, the biggest industry is a large Westinghouse plant. On the prototype, this industry was the largest on the St. Louis sub and received raw materials to manufacture large transformers. A local dedicated to the Westinghouse plant works this industry as a turn job out of Franklin Yard. A branch line takes off from North Jefferson to serve Columbia, Missouri. The trackage travels the center of the peninsula to form a stub-ended branch. Here, several customers, parentheses, some prototypical, some not, close parentheses, keep the local crew busy as they make the round trip from Franklin Yard to Columbia during a normal session. The prototype abandoned the branch in 1978, but I wanted to keep it operational to provide extra work for my operating crews. Mokane and Rhineland are next as the track winds its way around the peninsula of the layout. Both towns have long passing sidings and serve small agricultural communities. Rounding the curve past the peninsula, you enter St. Charles, a suburb of St. Louis on the prototype, and a large industrial area on the layout. At St. Charles, we have the Tavern Rock Sand and Gravel Company, a prototype industry that was served by the MKT, an auto rack facility, Safety Clean, a TOFC ramp, and an American Car and Foundry railcar repair facility. The MKT interchanges with the Norfolk and Western at this location, another concession to add operational interest. Past St. Charles, the track punches through the wall behind the furnace and enters Baden Yard. This prototype location was the end of the line for the Katy, where it interchanged with many other St. Louis railroads and the St. Louis Terminal Railway Association. Evolving construction methods. My introduction into the model railroading hobby was through a local N-Track modular club. My father and I built several models and traveled the Midwest, attending train shows and running on the club layouts. What really appealed to me about this aspect of the hobby was the socialization that goes along with running trains during the weekends at the various shows. My involvement in this portion of the hobby taught me how to build modular framework using 1x4 lumber with plywood tops and sturdy legs. When I built my home layout, I initially used these construction techniques. Much of the bench work along the perimeter of my layout, which is attached to the wall, is constructed using 1x4 box modules similar to the N-Track modules. As time went on and I learned more about layout construction, I moved to the typical L-girder framework. The L-girder technique was used to build the interior peninsula and branch line up to the Columbia. The track is primarily Micro Engineering Code 55 Flex Track with Atlas Flex Track and turnouts in the staging yards. Originally, many of the turnouts were Micro Engineering and Pico Code 55, filed to fit with the Micro Engineering Flex Track, but now I'm grateful to say that nearly all my turnouts are hand-built by my good friend and electronic mentor, Joe Casper. I am very fortunate that Joe is willing to help me upgrade my turnouts. The improvement in operation was a significant evolution on the layout. Thank you for joining us for the Model Railroader Magazine, read by Jason Consul.
You've been listening to the Model Railroader, brought to you by Trains.com. That's TRANES.com, in collaboration with AfterSight. If you've enjoyed this episode, we invite you to visit our website at AfterSight.org for more audio editions and original podcasts. For additional inquiries or to contact us, call us at 303-786-7777 or email contact@aftersight.org. Thank you for listening.